Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2018, and you're listening to episode 68 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Corey Latta, and Corey is a writer, teacher, and public speaker, and holds MAs in religion and English, and a PhD in 20th century literature. He is the author of several books, including C.S. Lewis and the Art of Writing, and he currently serves as the director of discipleship and young adults at Christ Church in Memphis, Tennessee. Corey wrote a feature article in the volume 41, number one issue of the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Something Made, The Role of Form in Apologetics. Corey, it's good to have you on.
Yeah, thanks, Melanie. Good to be here.
Well, I want you to explain to us a little bit about what you mean by form and the role of form in apologetics.
Sure. So form, just generally speaking, is a kind of creative shape given to an argument. We think of apologetics as maybe propositional or logical or doctrinal. When I'm talking about form, I'm really getting at the kind of shape an apologetic truth or an apologetic proposition can have creatively. I use in the article the categories that C.S. Lewis lays out in his book, An Experiment in Criticism, when he says there's logos and there's poema. Logos is something said, a statement, a word, a phrase, and poema is something made or something crafted. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about form. We're talking about the creative shape that an argument can have.
Well, why is the idea of form or the role of form in apologetics important?
Yeah, I think it really gets down to how God made us, that we are not just intellectual creatures. We are creative creatures. And more fundamentally and importantly, even, we're creatures of heart. We're sort of delving into the realm of the imagination when we're talking about form, creative form, creative shape. And the imagination, you know, gets talked about quite a bit. And there's kind of a cottage industry now, with imaginative apologetics, but I think we lose the core definition in all the, you know, maybe academic work on imagination apologetic. But really, what we're getting at is heart. That God made us to feel. He made us to intuit and know instinctively deep seated truths. Form is a way. Create a form is a way of getting at those truths in such a manner that it hits the heart. And not just the head, that it intersects with the deepest part of who we are and who we're made to be, so that these arguments cease to become just arguments and really settle into our souls as truths. I really think that form or shape captures something in our, enchants something in our humanity that proposition alone or like modal logic or you know, various forms of argumentation that those things can't quite get at.
Well, one thing that we're doing in the journal more recently in the last few years is doing literary apologetics, and you reference several works of literature in your article. And so I'd like to ask you what relationship you think that these texts have to do with apologetics. I really like your opening where you talk about a novel in that was written in the 1930s, and I was not familiar with that novel.
Yeah, Charles Williams, he was one of the famous Oxford Inklings, older, a little bit older than some of the others, and a lot more, just a lot more weird, really. He was a pretty esoteric guy. Brilliant, brilliant man, and in a way, a mind keener than even Lewis's or Tolkien's in his own way. But he wrote these kind of supernatural, realistic novels. It's like Charles Dickens meets magical realism, where he just infuses, very unapologetically, infuses spiritual truths, Christian truths, into these, you know, mundane fictive worlds. So there's a great novel he wrote in 37 called Descent into Hell. It's really a haunting novel. I remember the first time I read it in college, it kind of scared me to death. Just really a novel about how one goes to hell, how it's not just, you know, some momentary decision to follow Satan or something like that, or just reject God. It's really damnation by gradation. You choose the self again and again and again till finally you find yourself enclosed, trapped in on yourself for eternity. That's really the idea. But he's got this great scene where Pauline Anstruther, one of the protagonists of the novel, has this fear. She sees herself, like literally sees her doppelganger. And she's not a Christian. And there's a Christian character in the story, Peter Stanhope, who he's a play director and playwright, and she's participating in a play of his. And he hears about her story or situation and says, well, I'll tell you what, just give it to me. Give me the problem. Give me the struggle. And Pauline doesn't even know what that means. I mean, here's this very peculiar problem of seeing yourself, physically seeing your doppelganger. And here's this guy saying, just give it to me. What does that mean? And she doesn't understand. He says, well, you just need to give me the fear of it. And he says, you know, when Christ talks about carrying one another's burdens, I really think it's much closer to carrying a parcel for one another. And still hazy on what that means, she finally gives in and says, yes, fine, I don't want this burden anymore, take it. And he, in a very metaphysical, mysterious way, begins to carry her burden. But just me telling you that Christ carries your burden, or you telling me, hey, I want to carry that burden for you, just at an intellectual level, can only mean so much. The way that that truth sticks in the novel is really the image, the form of this exchange and this offer by Peter Stanhope to physically carry something that's not at all physical. It's the whole trope or the convention that makes that such a powerful image. It communicates something that I just couldn't communicate by mere non-fictive prose or, you know, just mere proposition.
You know, I want to say to our listeners, for all of you who are not English majors, because I was an English major, that magical realism that you mentioned just a few minutes ago, Corey, is just, if you're reading a novel that is just seems like it's based in reality, all of a sudden some kind of fantastical element mm-hmm. will be woven into the story, and it just kind of takes you by surprise. In other words, in the midst of a novel, that just might be about the real world. Yeah. So in case you're wondering what magical realism was, and I was not familiar with this author before you mentioned him. Now, you talked about just briefly C.S. Lewis making the distinction between something said and between something made. So can you explain that a little bit more to us?
Yeah. In the text, An Experiment in Criticism, which is a really, really great work of literary criticism by Lewis, maybe his best. He says, you know, we're talking about two different things when we're talking about a work of literature. There's the thing said, that's the logos. And, you know, Christian listeners will perk up when they hear logos, because it's the word used for Jesus in the Gospel of John. And the word logos literally means word. So it is the statement itself, literarily speaking. So Lewis says, obviously there is the statement of the thing. There are the words on the page. There are the propositions, the ideas. Poema, though, is as biblical as logos. Poema actually occurs in the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, where Paul actually says that we, the church, Christians, are God's poema. And this is the word from which we get the word poetry. In most English translations, that phrase in Ephesians 2:10 is we are God's workmanship. But the word there is poema. And you could say that Paul's saying we are the thing made by God, not just the thing made, but the creative iteration of God. He doesn't just say something to us or even say something through us, but he's made us into something. We have a particular creative shape. So I think apologetics, when we're talking about something said and something made, apologetics has to take on, this is what gets oftentimes lost, even by brilliant, brilliant apologist. So I think it's lost in that the emphasis is usually on that which is said and not that which is made. So, you know, we've got all kinds of examples of Christian apologists or Christian writers, Christian thinkers who have done both. Most people will be familiar with something like C.S. Lewis's The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, where he doesn't just start preaching Aslan, who is the Christ. Well, he doesn't start preaching Jesus, I should say, or just present a lion and say, hey, this is Christ. He gives a fully rounded character that is Aslan, who represents a kind of Christ. He's the Christ figure of the story. And he has this, you know, this lion with this fully formed, robust personality go through the same motions, experience the same experiences as Christ did in his sacrificial death and resurrection. And then he begins to interact with all these kids in this fantasy world of Narnia in much the same way Christ reveals himself in Scripture. That is not just something said. Lewis is not just writing a Christology there, you know, a work about Jesus. He is showing us in form, in creative form, giving shape to Christology. It's something that we see. You mentioned literature earlier. As I get into it several times in the article, I reference several literary scholars, because I really think that our creative writers have a lot to teach us here. I think our creative writers have gotten down pat the idea of poema in such a way that, you know, apologists and theologians could take a page from their book. But, you know, an author like Cormac McCarthy, who's most certainly not referred to as a Christian author, many, many, many times in his works, he will have a theme or a scene or a conversation or a character that creatively gives shape to something that is thoroughly biblical and profoundly theological. But he does it in such a creative, evocative way as to not just say something, but make something. So that's kind of what we're getting at with that distinction.
You mentioned in the article, specifically his book, The Road, which won a Pulitzer Prize. And I recall when I read that book, it was such a deeply affecting work. There's just so much I thought could be used as an apologetics tool, to be a springboard to talk about so many things that non-Christians would need to grapple with. And I agree with you. There's a lot of things that can be really considered in even in the work of someone like Cormac McCarthy, who's not even a Christian.
That's right.
But because his work is so thoughtful. Yeah. You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. And today, our guest is Corey Latta, who wrote a feature article in Volume 41, Number 1, issue of the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called Something Made, The Role of Form in Apologetics. To read Corey's article in the current issue, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. To subscribe online, visit equip.org. So I would like to ask you what you think some of the best models for form in apologetics. What are some of those things that some of our listeners could read?
There are, honestly, you know, again, some of these arguments or some of these examples, I should say, come from non-Christians. You mentioned The Road, painful story, and not even 10 pages in that story, you know, the father is looking at the son and this post-apocalyptic, disastrous world of utter sadness and death. And he looks at his son and says, if this is not the word of God, then God never spoke. I have never come across a theologian even say something about something so powerfully incarnational and emotional that conveys the truth of identity between Father and Son, God the Father, God the Son, the passion of a relationship. It just captures so many things in ways I've never quite heard that put. So somebody like Cormac McCarthy, his Blood Meridian, if you want to understand depravity, you're going to get maybe the most fully orbed picture of depravity you could ever ask for in Blood Meridian. I'm a massive Hemingway fan. I think Hemingway shows us the questions of the human condition more effectively than anyone. Obviously, the answer would be Christ, but we have to ask good questions to get to that ultimately good answer. Hemingway does that. There are all kinds of poets, T.S. Eliot, W.H. Auden, William Carlos Williams, Gerald Manley Hopkins. There are all kinds of poets who it's their task not to just tell us something, but to show us something, to create something for us. I would encourage apologists to be more in tune with creative writing and more tapped into people like Wendell Berry, Marilynne Robinson, even someone like a David Foster Wallace. If you don't understand the postmodern condition, you're not going to get it from a systematic theology. You're going to find it in David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest.
That's a very intimidating book that you're recommending to people. So I think people should go knowing that if they want to check that out, that it's a very important work of literary fiction, but also a huge tome.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's, enter at your own risk, it's a beast. But just, the questions that those guys are asking, really, really powerful. And I would say that part of the challenge for me is I need to understand the Kalam cosmological argument or the theological argument or the relationship between science and faith. But in most all of those are logical infrastructures on which we can build these kind of ironclad proofs for there being a higher power, or if you're talking about the resurrection historically happened, and they're needed. What they don't do, though, is, again, appeal to the heart and present the truths in as powerful a way as they can be presented to hit the entire human experience. So the challenge for me is to know these apologetic arguments, but also know just who I'm sending these arguments out to. I'm not just sort of calculating these arguments the way I would write a mathematical equation and sending them out to the ether. I'm sharing these arguments with people who have souls and emotional lives and who are first and foremost spiritual creatures who are made by God to react to creative truths. So there's always a challenge to know your stuff intellectually, but also creatively think about how you're going to present your stuff. And again, I think there we need to turn to our friends in the fiction, poetic, dramatic world.
My husband and I have been hosted a book club since 1996. So it's been 22 years. And I would say, and we kind of have a rule, we only read literary fiction and we try to read things that have just been published in the last 5 years. But what I like about it, even though there's Christians in the club and we don't have any non-Christians, it's been a great springboard because I'm reading a lot of stuff that non-Christians I meet also read. And it's a great way to engage them in conversation that you might not be able to just, with straight up classical apologetic arguments and weaving it into conversation. But you certainly can bring up those things through the shared experience of reading some literature together or poetry and those kinds of things. So how do you see the state of apologetics today in relation to what you're saying about form?
Yeah, I think we still – now, so there has been a kind of a boon, when it comes to imaginative apologetics. It's a popular phrase now, and you have several apologists, probably some who have no doubt written for the journal, who are delving into and doing good work with imaginative apologetics. My fear, though, is that even there, imaginative apologetics has been almost, what's the best way to say it, sort of reduced to, again, the level of proposition alone. Like, looking at a example from a creative text and saying, see, this is the incarnation, without jumping right to the doctrine presented, without spending a lot of time in the power of the scene itself, or kind of letting the creative nature of the text do its own work. I almost maybe an attempt to explain it away. So my fear with this new interest or area of imaginative apologetics is that we're not fully aware of what we mean when we say imagination, that this is the faculty we've been given by God to speak from and speak to the human heart. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about the imagination. It's not just the mental faculty to create imaginary images or to create, to image make. It is that first and foremost. But these images almost, I mean, they always appeal to, as they're meant to by God, appeal to the heart. So I think the future of apologetics has to be more cardiological, if you know what I mean. Like, it has to appeal to the human condition fully and to the heart more. Because the mystery of the gospel and the beauty of the gospel is that it's logical and it's valid, and it holds up under the weight of argumentation, but it is still a work of the Spirit that acts in and on the human heart. That's why heart is emphasized so many times in Scripture. So I think apologetics has to really, we apologists have to be careful not to detach what it is we make, what it is we say, from not just the mind, but from the heart. I think there's, you know, this is like the golden age of apologetics, it seems. So many wonderful apologists presenting wonderful arguments. The majority of them, though, seem to be propositional in nature. And I get that. We are in a day in which the very fabric of truth seems to be, you know, coming unraveled. And subjectivism is running rampant. So there is massive need to lay the foundation of objectivism again and sort of say, okay, theologically speaking, sort of say this is a universal truth from which we can build to present, you know, an argument for God. But yeah, I really do think that the future of apologetics is going to have to spend more time thinking about, and this is where, like, we're just talking about literature. We haven't even talked about psychology, for example. There are psychological arguments and experiments and studies that do the same thing, that give shape to a gospel truth, you know. Film. Film is, I remember watching, you know, Chris Nolan's Interstellar, and Anne Hathaway's character says, there are certain things that aren't utilitarian. For example, love. Love has no social utility. Her point being that it is just an innate, non-constructed human truth. I wanted to stand up in the theater and go, that's it. I mean, that if you can establish that, then you're on the road to getting to a God. So there's all kind of, you know, same thing with this, the role of beauty and art. There's all kinds of disciplines which we can learn from and lean into to give shape to what it is we're claiming. So I think the future of apologetics has to be extremely interdisciplinary, extremely creative, and extremely pathological, appealing to the pathos, not just the logos in the people we are talking to.
Well, listeners of this podcast will know that that's why we've expanded quite a bit film reviews through the podcast and free online film reviews that we post up there from the Christian Research Journal, just because of the very things that you're talking about. If anybody hasn't already read the review or seen the film from last year called Arrival, that is an extremely powerful film that right. is very much of a pro-life film, and, you know, is based on a short story. And while it is got a sci-fi theme and aliens, it's extremely profound about brokenness and what it means to choose hard things and to choose how to live your life, knowing what you might know about your life. It's a beautiful film. And like I said, it was also based on a short story. So I would highly recommend that to our listeners and readers, because that's specifically a movie I think that does reach the heart. It's got themes in it that all human beings can relate to.
Absolutely. For sure. 100%.
So what can those, you know, some of us that are apologists, you know, we're lay apologists, and we want to defend our faith. So what can we learn about, additionally learn about the role of form in apologetics that we should know?
I think to be more wide-eyed, more open-eared, and more full-hearted. Obviously, be, you know, sharp-minded, but to do just like with Arrival, to go into every experience. You know, it was a Henry James who said, "Strive to be someone on whom nothing is lost." That's the role of the apologist. I've got to catch everything. I can't do things passively. So to watch something like Arrival and to glean, to know the word, number one, to know the word well enough that I can see these truths presented creatively in film, art, literature and be able to correspond. My experience when my, and I'll maybe use this as a form of encouragement, my experience when I was in my doctorate program in literature was reading James Joyce and Whitman and Dickinson, and there was biblical reference after biblical reference after biblical allusion after biblical allusion, and no one, including the professors, no one could catch them. No one was familiar with them. They were more worried about, you know, sex, class, and race, or some sort of new critical approach or something like that. And I kept calling attention to the fact that, man, right here in Ulysses, Joyce is, he's talking about the sacrament of, communion here, the Eucharist, or he's referring to John 3, or, and it was just amazing to me. So to be wide-eyed enough and aware enough of both the Bible and this cultural artifact, whether it be movie or a story, to say, hey, there's an association that's important, to be able to trace, you know, the whole just a martyr idea of all truth being God's truth, to be able to trace this truth outside of text back to the text, therefore back to Christ. I just think we have to be very diligent about that and be wide-read, to be interdisciplinary, to be diligent, and to be sober and alert-minded enough to pay attention to what it is we watch, what it is we read, what it is we hear, so that we can actually spot these truths that correspond to, the universal and scriptural truth of God. I think that's the, you know, for the average lay Christian who wants to fulfill 1 Peter 3:15 to be ready to give an answer. Those answers are coming from scripture, but they're also being presented and are present in all these cultural artifacts, you know, film and story and music and things like that. But they're no good to you if you can't spot them, you know.
So how do you think forming apologetics and imagination you talked about, but truly embracing that, not maybe an academic approach to imagination and apologetics, how do you think it'll look like going forward? And do you think it's going to be more vital than ever, you know, in our post-Christian world, or less vital in terms of just navigating with using your apologetics tools in our increasingly secular society?
I think we need more Christian creatives. I think we need more people creating, you know, being about the business of poema, not just saying Christian truths. We definitely need that. We'll always need that. But people who are in the business of making music, of making literature, and making film. And, you know, I don't necessarily mean the genre of Christian film or Christian song. Nothing wrong with that, I suppose. But of making just good music, good film, good art, that in its goodness and in its innate nature points back to the redemptive truths of Christianity. I think it was C.S. Lewis said, you can bet that when Jesus was a carpenter and made a table, he first made a good table. He didn't make a Christian table. So we need to make good art. I think in the making of good art, we are fulfilling, you know, one half of the apologetic task, to not just say what needs to be said, but make what needs to be made. And tease out and trust the, you know, the meanings of that creation. So I think we need more Christian creatives. I also think we have to be more mindful of the ways culture recognizes truth. That doesn't mean to kowtow to culture. We have to be flat-footed in the claims of the gospel and Christian truth here, but we have to be mindful of how it is culture sees truth and be able to at least converse. You know, the great example of this is Acts 17. Paul doesn't go up and just sort of blow up the Athenian system of, or the Greco-Roman system of pagan worship. He eventually will. He does with the person of Christ, but he uses, instead of explodes, he utilizes idolatrous worship by saying, hey, you know, I notice you have a statue to an unknown God. Well, let me tell you about that God. That's wielding a cultural artifact, you know, in this case, a pagan religious artifact, against the culture that produced it. I think there has to be that kind of nimble-mindedness on the part of the apologist, to be able to speak the language of culture, but speak it in such a way that we are introducing Christian truths in what we say and in what we make.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Corey. So Corey, you live in Memphis. What's your favorite barbecue restaurant?
One and only.
Are you an early bird or a night owl?
I'm a total night owl. My morning self hates my night self, but I'm a night owl.
Tell us an interesting fact about yourself that listeners and readers of our journal may not know.
I've got two sets of twins, my wife and I. That's maybe what sets us apart. We had four kids in under 2 years, boy, girl. The youngest just turned two, and the oldest will be four in July. So it's probably the best thing about me.
And you have a PhD in literature. So what is one of your favorite novels that you think that everybody should read?
Oh, man. I would say The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway. And I would follow that up with Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian.
Well, thanks, Corey, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Today's guest is Corey Lawton, and he wrote a feature article in the Volume 41, Number 1 issue of the Christian Research Journal, and his article is called Something Made, The Role of Form in Apologetics. To read Corey's article, please subscribe to the journal, and a 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. To subscribe online, go to our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes and rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others find our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Hank is also live streaming each week on Facebook and YouTube, so check equip.org for dates and times. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.